Hello, Sapiens, and welcome back to another episode of A Tribe of One. We have an awesome guest for this week's episode, Oren McMillan. Oren has been incredibly influential in the Web3 space, jumping in early, thinking about and building some of the key technologies that will power the future of decentralized finance. He currently works with Gnosis, a company building Ethereum infrastructure, which is best known for their multi-signature wallet product, and their Gnosis DAO, which is sweeping the discourse. Oren is also the founder of ClearFund, a community that uses quadratic funding to support public good projects, and he advises BrightID, which is a public good organization providing an alternative to traditional identity solutions. We get into it in the episode, so don't worry about missing that. This was a fun conversation that pushed the boundaries of the conversations that are swirling around in the crypto community and plunged headfirst into the nitty-gritty of how we can build better for the future. So one note for our listeners unfamiliar with some of the terms we were slinging around. DAO is a popular acronym for decentralized autonomous organizations, which are basically independent groups of people that make decisions and share value through mechanisms often driven by a token. We really enjoyed this conversation, and we hope you enjoy listening. Have a great week, Sapiens. Here's Oren McMillan. All right, Oren, welcome to A Tribe of One. To kick us off, we'd love to learn a little about yourself, maybe some of the tribes that you're a part of, and you can introduce yourself to our listeners.
Yeah. Hey, everyone. Hey, I'm Keith. Good to be here. Thanks for having me. I don't know. I'm not sure where to start. I guess I am working with Gnosis at the moment. We are a kind of Ethereum infrastructure company, building a whole bunch of things that most people interact with on some level. Probably the biggest kind of consumer-facing thing that we're building at the moment is the Gnosis Safe. So a lot of users kind of interact with that as the kind of more secure option for storing their funds, their NFTs, and for kind of interacting with DeFi and the rest of the ecosystem. The Gnosis Safe is essentially a multi-sig wallet solution. And then outside of that, yeah, we work on a whole bunch of other interesting kind of infrastructure projects, things like the Open Ethereum client, Gnosis Protocol, which is a DEX aggregator layer, and then Gnosis Auction is a recent development for running kind of batch auctions, and then a whole bunch of DAO tooling, which is what I'm kind of focused on right now, building DAO tooling. And then in my spare time, I work on a project called ClearFund, which is a quadratic funding protocol for the Ethereum ecosystem.
Nice. So there's a lot of technical projects that we do want to dive into, but you know, maybe you can also share a little bit of your personal life or kind of where you're coming from. What's your story and what do you do outside of the whole Web3 space?
Right. I mean, I guess I have a bit of a weird, different entry way into the Web3 ecosystem. Prior to kind of falling down that rabbit hole, I played basketball professionally, mostly out in Australia in the NBL, and then what was called the CBL at the time, and then also some short stints over in Europe. And then I guess academically, my background is in psychology and experimental research methods. And yeah, I fell down the crypto rabbit hole in, say, 2013, and have been kind of tumbling ever since. I got really actively involved in 2016 around the DAO, founded a forum called DAO Hub, which ended up being the kind of de facto home for the DAOs community. And from that, kind of had a baptism of fire in terms of supporting kind of growing communities through you know, like a really meteoric rise and then a pretty catastrophic fall of the DAO. And then after that, have kind of branched out and worked with a whole bunch of different projects in the space, mostly focused around governance-related projects or kind of like the governance aspects of different projects, along with community management, community building, product management, with a tiny little bit of development sprinkled in here and there.
Nice, nice. Yeah, one thing I really find fascinating is your psychology background and kind of how that maps over to Web3, because so much about Web3 is all about incentives, aligning incentives. You know, how do people think and behave? And, you know, with Bitcoin, that was like one of the first things that Satoshi provided a solution for, right? Like being able to have this trustless coordination and consensus around on blocks. So how do you sort of see your experimental research background influencing your work in Web3?
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I honestly don't think I'm all that conscious of it often. I think I probably approach a lot of the problems that I see kind of with an unconscious bias towards thinking about them from a kind of behavioral psychology and game theory perspective, but I don't necessarily put a ton of conscious effort into that. I do definitely agree though, like the thing that really interests me, or one of the things that really interests me about cryptocurrencies, and one of the things that I think is a reason for one of the primary reasons for their success is they're really, I guess, the attention to detail in terms of incentive alignment. And yeah, I guess that's, again, it's definitely one of the things that has drawn me into the space and held me in the space, you know, helped me exploring and designing mechanisms to kind of create some emergent behavior out of kind of well-aligned incentives is a really fun challenge.
Are there any particular examples of that, of those mechanisms, Oren, that stand out?
Yeah, I mean, so Ankit, you hinted at it a minute ago, talking about Bitcoin and Ethereum and essentially like the proof of work consensus algorithm. And so that's a really interesting one there, where the emergent result that you want is essentially a secure network. You want a network where transactions get broadcast in a relatively, included into a block in a relatively timely manner, but in a way that's secure, in a way that solves the Byzantine generals problem. And so the proof of work algorithm is a really great example of that, where you have individuals kind of acting in their own mutual self-interest, and the emergent result of that. And when I say mutual self-interest, like they are hashing for profit. And then, yeah, the emergent result of all of that, of them kind of running nodes, is a functioning network. The other example of it that I really like, and that I put a lot of time into working with over the last year and a half, is quadratic funding, where the kind of desired outcome is essentially well-funded public goods, or at least a well-allocated kind of matching pool to fund public goods. And so the inputs to that system are essentially individuals contributing to projects that they value, and then the emergent result is a well-allocated matching pool.
Hmm. Yeah, and I think Gitcoin has seen a lot of success with quadratic funding. I think they're just like the ability to support so many projects that otherwise would not have the opportunity to build. I think that's amazing. I think they're up to some really cool things. I think, you know, I do want to take a step back, and maybe if you could briefly just talk about quadratic funding, for our listeners, just so those that aren't familiar can better understand the concept, that'd be great.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're spot on. Like Gitcoin has really opened a lot of people's eyes to the kind of magic of quadratic funding, and given a huge number of projects and people an opportunity to kind of monetize work that would otherwise go largely unrecognized and unpaid. So they've done a fantastic job, and kind of all kudos to them. They've really, really helped push the space forward. For anyone that hasn't heard of quadratic funding before, again, it's an algorithm for efficiently allocating funds to public goods. The way that it works is you have a matching pool of funds. And so this is essentially a pool of funds that someone, as a kind of philanthropic contributor, says, I would like to contribute money to broadly to some kind of space or some kind of scope of projects or to some kind of cause. So in this case, in the case of ClearFund or Gitcoin, it's Ethereum public goods, essentially like projects that are beneficial broadly to most people in the Ethereum space. So yeah, anyone, any kind of company, project, person can contribute funds to this matching pool. The idea being that the mechanism will then distribute those funds proportionally to each of the kind of public goods recipients projects. And how it figures out how to allocate that is basically by taking the inputs from individuals who contribute directly to the projects that they value. So me as a user, I might say I value kind of projects X, Y, and Z. So I'm going to contribute to those projects directly. And my contributions to those projects basically count as a vote towards allocating a portion of the matching pool to those projects. The way that votes are calculated is using essentially quadratic voting, which is you take the square root, you take the square root of the amount of funding that you contribute to any of those projects, and that square root is basically your vote weight towards that project. And then the way that the matching pool is actually allocated in the end is using the sum of the square roots from each of the people that vote for that project relative to the sum of the square roots that were allocated elsewhere, which sounds kind of really complex. And so like to make it a little more accessible, essentially what it's talking about is, or essentially what it does is it makes it more efficient for everyone involved. So from a philanthropic point of view, contributing to the matching pool, I'm able to ensure that my contribution is well allocated without all of the traditional overhead that it would take to run essentially a grants committee. So I can, I have two options. I can set up a grants committee to allocate this large pool of funds and, have them take applications, sift through all of them, and do kind of all of the manual work to figure out where they think they should allocate it. This is it's high bandwidth and it's necessarily kind of has a limited number of inputs that it can take into account. So it always ends up having some kind of bias. And then the alternate is you can drop it into this matching pool. You have none of that overhead of having a grants committee, and instead you take inputs from all of the individual contributors. So you it's much more efficient from that point of view. But then the other side of it is it's your matching pool contributions actually then elicit additional contributions from the public to the projects that they support. So not only do you cut down on your bandwidth costs to actually allocate the funds, but you also increase the total amount of funds that get sent to public goods, that get contributed to public goods. So it's much, much more efficient from a philanthropic point of view. And then it's also much more efficient from the individual contributor's point of view. And essentially that's because say there's a project that I value, I could choose to send them funds directly. Say I choose to send them $10, then they get $10. But if I choose to route that contribution through a quadratic funding round, they get my $10, but they also get a portion of the matching pool. So my $10 that I contribute is translates to $10 plus some portion of the matching pool for that recipient. So it's this really beautiful kind of virtuous cycle there that is more efficient for everyone involved.
Yeah, no, that's really powerful. And I think one other sort of facet of this algorithm is that it's more resistant to individuals sort of trying to manipulate or make a disproportionate amount of power because of the square rooting, right? So I really appreciate that as a quality too. It makes it more democratic and egalitarian as far as the way that, you know, these funds are dispersed from the shared
pool. And so it's important there when you're talking about like more resilient to qualify like more resilient to what? And I think what you're hinting at there is that the status quo in terms of decision making for most DAO-like structures is essentially this plutocratic setup where one token or one coin or $1 or whatever it is equals one vote. And so, yeah, in that case, then you can have a radical kind of disparity between the vote weight that two different people have based purely on the amount of capital that they have access to. Whereas quadratic voting and quadratic funding take the square root of those numbers. And so there's this kind of rapidly diminishing returns on kind of greater and greater contributions.
I think one issue I struggle with the quadratic voting is the incentive it introduced to sort of buy other people's votes, right? Or create new identities to try and, disperse your vote. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on how that might be addressed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a really, really pivotal piece to any quadratic funding or quadratic voting setup, and really for any system that is aiming to be kind of more democratic. You know, like if you're aiming to disperse power across a greater number of people, then you obviously need to make sure that it's difficult for people to kind of coerce or control or fake numerous people. And so that's something that ClearFund and Gitcoin both have put a ton of effort into addressing. In the case of Gitcoin, they have a variety of different ways that you can kind of verify and kind of stack verifications on top of each other to gain essentially like a trust bonus in their rounds. And in the case of ClearFund, we use a system called BrightID as our proof of uniqueness. And so we rely kind of exclusively on that for our rounds as our civil protection, understanding that it's not 100% effective. Like there is the potential for people to spin up multiple accounts, but the point where you really start to damage a quadratic funding system is not if you can spin up, you know, a small handful of accounts. That's obviously kind of disingenuous and a bit of a bummer. But the point where you really start to damage it is when you can spin up hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands and kind of really start to create a disproportionate impact on the spread of the voting.
Yeah, and I want to bring up this very interesting tweet that you had last year, Oren, that you tweeted out, identity is overrated. Prove you're unique, the rest is redundant. And I thought that was really interesting, right? Why do you, what are the differences you see between identity and uniqueness? And, why is it just sufficient to be unique?
Right. So, this is obviously showing my bias in the types of systems that I'm trying to create and interact with. But, in the context of those systems, in many of those systems, that it's sufficient to prove that you're a unique individual within the context of that system. The system doesn't need any additional information. But the status quo for proving uniqueness is to, in the Web 2 world or in the kind of the legacy world is to, show your driver's license or your passport or something like this that has all this additional data, and it's totally redundant. You don't need to know my name and my address and my date of birth and my blood type and, like all of these other things to know that I'm a unique individual in the context of a system. And so that's one of the reasons that I really love BrightID is because they totally keyed in on this in terms of the only thing that you need to prove, or the only thing that you share with the system is the fact that you are unique. There's other projects that I think have taken that have worked on kind of providing similar things for other types of data. Bloom is another kind of identity project. And what they've really looked to do is create a system where you can prove aspects of your identity without revealing your identity or without revealing any kind of additional information beyond what you need to. And so a good example of that would be, say, like age verification. You don't need to know that I'm 34 to let me into a bar. You need to know that I'm older than 21 or older than 18, depending on where you are in the world. You don't need to know my name. You don't need to know my address. You don't need to know anything about me, just that I'm older than some threshold. And so I think like this is a really great use case for things like Bloom, where you can prove just some aspect about yourself as opposed to who you are and kind of revealing, leaking all of this additional information. And it's something that has like the way that we currently deal with this has some really significant implications for kind of security and privacy for people. So that taking the bar example, it's really common for you to have to hand over your ID to a bouncer, and it's become increasingly common for the bouncer then to go and put it into some machine that flashes all your details up onto a big screen that is usually not well shielded from the public. And so it's like, in order to get into this bar, I'm now leaking all of this information to anyone that's within kind of viewing distance of this screen. And I think that has some really huge potential like security implications, in the context of like a nightclub where there could be people looking to, follow people home and stuff like that. So this that type of thing is what really motivated that tweet and has really informed that kind of opinion that essentially you should only share or only be required to share the minimum amount of information to validate that you should be let through the gates into some system. And anything beyond that is essentially a risk.
Mm-hmm. I think for many people, it might be hard to imagine how you could sort of prove things like this without sharing personal details. Do you have an example of how you might be able to prove something like your age without having to share any of this?
Right. And so I think there's more than likely a huge design space on how those type of things might work. But one, in the context of a nightclub or something like that, you know, potentially there's some kind of Oracle service where, you know, the nightclub trusts that this Oracle service is going to report the right data, that the Oracle service has access to all of your information. But when you show up to the nightclub, you give them your kind of ID card and maybe it's got your face on it so they can kind of visually face match you. And then all it asks for is, you know, are you older than X? In which case, you know, the nightclub and anyone else who's peering over the screen sees that, you know, sees your face, which they can already see because you're out in the open, and they can see that you're older than X, but there's nothing else that's revealed. So that might be a kind of simple, similar kind of solution there, where you're only revealing the bare minimum information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is certainly like one of the things that really draws me to the space of Web3. You know, when Rob and I first started Sapien, the approach that we were thinking was to encrypt everything, right? All posts, comments was end-to-end encrypted in a sort of similar mission, right? That we wanted to basically provide the least possible information, even to the servers. That, you know, ended up not being as fruitful as a path, but the premise was still the same. And again, it really resonates with me that, you know, this is possible now. We can build these privacy-preserving systems if we design them right, where we are literally just giving the minimal amount to validate and to verify without compromising the rest of our private life, right? I think that's really a beautiful vision for what can be, as opposed to, you know, something like the Minority Report future, where, you know, every sort of piece of information is just public and it's just being used in the attention economy by advertisers. I think we can avoid that entire sort of path and go towards something that, you know, preserves digital sovereignty at the end of the day. So really, really am looking forward to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, talking about identity and Brand ID is also, you know, a project that I've been following, and they do have like two components to them. They obviously have the video component that, you know, you're kind of jumping on, you're seeing people on video, and you can verify them, you send them a token, and in the background, they're creating this network graph and identifying sort of pathways and pointing out, you know, this person, you know, is probably human, that person's probably not. They're doing something in the background there. Do you feel that sort of system is sufficient, or, I mean, do you have any sort of preferences between Bloom or Bright ID? Do you think that there's more that needs to be added there, or is that, you know, just because I'm having a conversation with you, I can send you a token and verify that, hey, you're about as human as you can be. Is that sufficient for proving uniqueness?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there's a couple of pieces of that. In terms of like the comparison between Bloom and Bright ID, I think they, to a certain extent, solve for different problems, where Bright ID is like very specifically geared towards solving this uniqueness problem in a relatively trustless way. Whereas Bloom, so far as I'm aware, is kind of more positioned to help solve for that kind of privacy problem, where you have some authority that is set up to validate some information, and Bloom basically creates a pathway between the person who wants this kind of minimal information and this authority. And so it's like you have your Bloom ID, and via that you can verify that you're over 18. Based, you know, according to some authority, without having to verify or without having to reveal your name and how old you are and all that kind of stuff. So they're kind of similar or kind of like adjacent projects in that from that point of view. And Bloom could potentially solve for the same problem in terms of uniqueness, but they'd be deferring the actual uniqueness part to some authority, which could be something like Bright ID. It could be something like a national registry of people or kind of some other system. And in terms of like specifically for Bright ID, like whether I think their solution is sufficient to date, it seems to have worked fairly well for ClearFund. It's important to understand kind of what it's actually providing. And it's not like a concrete proof of uniqueness. Like you can't guarantee that every single person in the system is or every account in the system is just one person, but it does give you a kind of probabilistic guarantee of uniqueness. Or it just says, you know, like that as a system, we're X percent sure that each of these users is unique, and we're basically making a judgment that you know, as long as that threshold is above some percentage, the system will behave for the most part as intended. I do think there's some interesting layers that can be added on top of Bright ID to improve it. One of those is Apala, which is a relatively recent project that basically extends projects like Bright ID and Proof of Humanity and Identity Network to create a kind of game theoretic incentive for good behavior. And essentially what it's doing is saying, like, you create a group, a pool of funds that you allow anyone who meets some requirements to join this pool. They put some funding in to become a member of the pool. And then any one of those members can choose to destroy their account to take a chunk of that funding from the pool. So essentially, like, you put, say, $5 in, and then you can immediately blow up your account and take $10 out. So the pool will become insolvent if enough people explode their account. But the idea is that you want to set it up so that being a member of this group is more valuable than your ability to kind of blow it up. And generally, like, the point at which it's not is if you are someone who's creating an army of bots and you know, essentially trying to gain access to it just to pull the money out. And so, yeah, I think Apollo is an interesting kind of additional layer on top of that that could help to tie together some of the otherwise kind of competing uniqueness standards.
Yeah, no, that's you know, really, really powerful, actually, you know, when you think about it. And, you know, what came to mind was also Mollark DAO, the way that they're configured. I think they have a similar mechanism where, you know, they have the ability to pull out funds, you know, if you are a member there. And yeah, I think we're just still only scratching the surface with just some of these incentive models that are possible now. I think it's just so important, I think, you know, for everyone listening, right, as to, like, why these things are so important, right? Like, why is voting so important? Why is identity so important? I mean, what is trying to be achieved at the end of the day, right? And the way that, you know, we like to frame it at Sapien is that, you know, we're trying to build a future of these digital tribes, these communities, and what it looks like, right? And that translates into different words like DAOs and whatnot. But at the end of the day, it's about a group of people coming together on the internet and being able to do spectacular things that they otherwise couldn't do. So I really like to kind of think about, you know, all the work that you're doing, or in all the great work, you know, across Gnosis and Clear Fund and integrating with identity, how you sort of see it shaping up to build that ideal version of the tribe, right? That ideal version of people coming together and having all these powerful tools to coordinate and make change.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really, really broad question. But I think, like, my ideal kind of scenario there is, like, enabling organizations that, like we talked about at the start, that essentially the desired outcome becomes this kind of emergent result of a bunch of uncoordinated actions, or kind of relatively low coordination actions, people kind of acting in their own mutual self-interest and producing something kind of much more kind of complex and much more beneficial to the kind of group as a whole. So again, that's one of my reasons for really loving the quadratic funding mechanism. But beyond that, I think, you know, the really high level goal is just to enable a future where, or really a present, you know, it exists now, you know, enable technology that can be used to create kind of essentially organizations with much lower barriers to entry, with much more open borders, and with much more kind of egalitarian governance structures. Yeah, I think that is the thing that really got me interested in the Ethereum space and the Web3 space to start with. And it's really starting to kind of take shape over the last, say, year and a half.
Yeah, and it's really, really just incredible what can be done now. And Rob, I don't know if you want to dive a little bit into just some of the things that we're thinking about at Sapien and how general these communities can be, because, you know, in the context of social, right, you can have anything from a group of gamers to, you know, a group of investors that are trying to coordinate across the world. But all of these sort of have the ability to come together, form powerful organizations and access these different tools. Rob, do you want to share a little bit about where our head's at?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's pretty amazing just how few sort of these sorts of primitives you need to really create and organize such a wide variety of organizations. I think, yeah, so one thing here is a token itself, right? Just a token offers so many tools in the ability to fund an organization to, you know, implement things as complex as governance via control over distribution and minting of a token. And combined with things like, you know, pulls or that can grant these tokens, it's really, those two things are sufficient to implement some really pretty complex organizations.
Tokens are a fantastic incentive alignment mechanism. You know, the ability to spin up a token and distribute it to a group of people to kind of signal or to kind of in practice create a shared ownership over something is something that, you know, it is much more difficult in the real world, you know, outside of the Web3 space. And so it's really, really cool and really, really quite inspiring to kind of see that happening more and more frequently throughout the space. And the last, again, you know, 6 to 8 months as particularly like the NFT space has blown up, and you've seen a lot more people coming into the crypto space focusing on kind of arts related projects as opposed to finance related projects has been incredible to watch and to witness as those people kind of start to form groups focused around very, very kind of different things. I think like PleaserDAO is a really great example of that, where you've got a group of essentially like fans of an artist that have coordinated around buying their artwork and then kind of evolved into their own community that now, you know, essentially owns and curates a collection of just digital artwork. It's fantastic.
Wow. And I think it really would be taken to the next level, you know, when these DAOs begin to really interact with each other. I think that's also something that everyone is building these emergent systems, but it's like, you know, when they do become these higher order DAOs, how will they sort of transact with each other? And that's really when you need tools like Gnosis, right? Because, you know, you will have multiple parties involved in signing transactions, and it needs to be done securely. And, you know, personally, just a huge fan of Gnosis technology. And I think we need more projects that are investing into some of these core infrastructure pieces to enable, you know, cross-DAO communication and coordination. So.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the things that we're really, really focused on at the moment at Gnosis, is essentially like enabling these multi-organizational networks, you know, enabling these organizations that start out as you know, a relatively small core group of people, but evolve into kind of a constellation of systems that interact with one another, that you know, have various kind of control structures that you know, vary wildly throughout the organization, and organizations that you know, whose tendrils reach out beyond like the home chain that they were launched on. So yeah, we have a current work stream towards enabling that, and obviously the Gnosis Safe is a big part of that. And then we've started building a whole bunch of other tools to I think really enable the same kind of composability that really sparked the kind of DeFi summer. You know, that really sparked the huge explosion in DeFi last year. What did that was essentially the fact that you could take the outputs of one system and use them as an input for another system, and by virtue of that, create these really interesting combinations of systems. And I think that's where the DAO space to date has been a little bit lacking. You know, these systems, these existing or legacy kind of DAO frameworks have the ability to interact with other systems, but kind of do so in a clunky way and tend to try to encourage more of a kind of siloed ecosystem, encourage everything to kind of move its way back into this kind of one unified interface and one unified kind of system of contracts. But what DeFi has really shown is like one of the core value propositions of the Ethereum space is composability, is this ability to kind of, you know, permissionlessly interact with and combine different pieces. And so that's a big part of what we're trying to do with our kind of DAO tools at Gnosis right now is enable that same kind of composability.
Yeah, you know, and speaking to DeFi, I mean, I just remember, you know, you would see these transactions linking, you know, several different apps together, you know, pulling from Yearn and getting into Uniswap and then getting out into Curve. And I'd be looking at it like, man, like, are these even humans that are doing these transactions? Because, you know, there's a lot of sort of systems that are being strung together right now, and you can tell, like, you know, there's bots involved in just making the whole thing work. And, you know, it's all just so fascinating because so much of the activity is happening in the background, and even Uniswap too, just something as basic as a DEX, you'll see bots are front running orders and, you know, trying to get ahead of human trades. but it's also exciting because I think again, this ties back to identity, but that'll become increasingly important as you're trying to really figure out who is the person doing the transaction at the end of the day. Maybe at some point it won't even matter. You know, you just say that this DAO, this transaction came out of this DAO. And yeah, I think this ties a bit to you know, what we think about when we say a tribe of one, right? That, you know, between the individual operator, the member of the DAO, and the DAO itself, that line starts to blur, right? Just as it always has with humans too. You know, we're all individuals, but we're also so much more than that. We're some of all the communities and projects that we're working on. And I think that same sort of thing will translate to digital in a very interesting way, right? Because, you know, you'll have this ability to be unique, but also be a part of something bigger. And I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, again, kind of goes back to what we were talking about at the start, you know, these essentially organizations that are greater than the sum of their parts, that are, you know, that have these beautiful and complex kind of emergent results from a bunch of you know, relatively simple interactions from individuals.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I guess we can dive a little bit into self-governance. And, you know, when we say self-governance, I think a lot of people quickly, you know, start thinking about like anarchy and, you know, just there's no sort of order. And you also had a sort of, I think, a sit with Colony, you know, around building these organizations and giving some of these governance tools. Could you speak a bit to how you look at governance and how you think is the way to build some of these more complex systems?
Yeah, I mean, when we're talking about governance, I think it's really important to clarify kind of what we're talking about governing, because it's, you know, like the solution really, really depends entirely on what the problem is, and different different organizations have wildly varying problem sets that you need a solution for, and there is no kind of one size fits all solution to governance. That the mechanism that you choose to use, or that the combination of mechanisms, really needs to be tailored to the outcomes that you're trying to elicit.
Yeah.
So when I talk about outcomes there, I guess I'm talking about, like, you know, like is your outcome to maximize shareholder profit, or to, you know, to allocate some funds to public good, or to you know, to count the voice of the most possible people, or to you know, return revenues to your member owners, or whatever it is. Like there's any number of different outcomes that or sets of outcomes that an organization might be optimizing for, and in any case, there's again any number of different possible solutions to it. You mentioned Colony. They've obviously been hugely impactful on my thinking around governance, and I am still very much a fan of Colony's solution. In particular, there's two things I like. One, there's many more than two, but two things in particular. So one is this idea of kind of meritocracy, the idea that you earn your voice in an organization by making contributions to it, and so, you know, as opposed to kind of purely democratic decision making, or plutocratic decision making, or quadratic decision making, this is a decision making mechanism that is, again, based on the weight of contributions that you've made to an organization over some period of time. And the thing that I particularly like about Colony's version of reputation is this the decay function that it has. So it's always it's essentially your recent contributions that give you the most weight in decision making. And so what that does is essentially give control of the organization to the people that are actively building it. And if you compare that to the traditional kind of startup world, the bulk of decision making power in a traditional VC backed startup is in equity holders, in the people that got in early and were able to kind of scoop up a decent chunk of equity. And so that's effectively this kind of plutocracy limited by your ability to limited by the kind of liquidity of that equity. Whereas again, in contrast, something like Colony, the decision-making power falls in the hands of the people that are kind of currently building it, that are actively building it. And that's obviously kind of normalized because the decay rate, or kind of smoothed, I should say, because it decays kind of slowly. But yeah, I think that's a really, really cool innovation there to shift that kind of balance of power. Mm. And the other part of that is the kind of decoupling of kind of governance rights and economic rewards, which Colony does really well. And then the second piece that I like to Colony's kind of governance mechanism is the lazy consensus portion of it, where essentially everything is assumed to be okay by default. If I create a motion to do something and nothing else happens, then the motion passes automatically and no one else has to have any input. And that's kind of in stark contrast to the way that the vast majority of decision-making happens in the DAO world, but much more reminiscent of how decision-making tends to happen in the real world, where you generally kind of delegate some power to kind of individuals and you pull back on that power if they abuse it. In Colony's version, you put up a stake in order to create a motion to do something, and then you if someone objects to it, then you can push it to some dispute resolution process. But if no one objects to it, then it just passes. And I think what we'll tend to see as a result of that is potentially an early kind of tumultuous period where people are kind of finding the norms, where organizations are kind of finding their norms. And once the norms have been established, then things should start to run much more smoothly, where people know the types of proposals that they can push through and not have any objections.
Yeah, I think two very interesting points, and I'll speak to them in reverse order. With the second point first, I think it's a very novel approach. I think we saw this as a problem with some of the early DAOs. I think like Tezos and I think Aragon as well. DAO Stack was facing some difficulties in this too. They just weren't getting enough holders to participate in the voting process, right? And that voting apathy is a serious issue, I think, in the decentralized space. Because hey, like, you know, you may be a member, but if you're not voting, like, it's not really the most effective way to participate in a DAO. And I'm really curious, because I think the whole space of incentivizing voting itself is underexplored, right? I think there's, you know, for tribes, I'm using the word tribes again, but for tribes that are really looking to make a vote that's very impactful, they could easily try to incentivize it or, you know, put additional layers on top. I think that would be very, very interesting to me. And the first point that you brought up around the way that we're, again, modeling some traditional equity, I think that is sort of the evolution of capitalism itself, right? And Rob, I'm curious to get your thoughts on this too, because I know we've had some very interesting discussions with some of the guests that have come on, but how you see sort of stocks sort of transitioning into tokens and the things we can do now with tokens.
Yeah, I think sort of a lot of the issues that we see in the modern economy come from, you know, the presence of too many barriers, too many gatekeepers, especially with things like access to capital, the inability of like small businesses, for example, to have access to public capital, I think is one of the main things that encourages monopolization, right? And the inability of like your local small mom and pop chains to be unable to withstand the Walmarts of the world. So I'd like to see some of this help change.
And it'd be really incredible if you could, create a token for some of these small businesses, and then, that serves almost as an index to all those local mom and pop shops, where, you know, in one sort of transaction, you can just become a supporter, across the board, across the nation.
Yeah, it might be something as simple too as you become a token holder when you shop at these stores, right? It could be a loyalty program that actually gives you a real stake. So things like this, I think, are really, really powerful, and really excited to see what we can do.
Yeah, that's interesting. Not something I've thought about a lot, but first, my gut reaction is to be skeptical that a token would help in that scenario, mainly because I think the reason that, you know, Walmart outcompetes mom and pop is just an economy of scale. You know, they have buying power to force the price of their goods much, much lower than what mom and pop have. And so like I could see a scenario where essentially, you know, a coalition or cooperative of mom and pops all over the country, you know, or all over the world, kind of band together to kind of create similar kind of buying power. And those type of co-op models exist already. But, you know, to date, they still haven't outcompeted something like Walmart.
The other thing that the token does that changes things is give access to the sort of the fanatical fan base certain like mom and pop stores might have, you know, people that are really diehard and really, really truly believe in and are willing to put a lot of resources, whether that's time or money, into seeing them succeed. And if they're able to align incentives and share in that success, I think that could potentially be a game changer.
Yeah, I mean, I think one part where this is probably true, and again, it could also be true of a kind of a co-op or alliance type model, it's just that it's from a kind of capitalism point of view, investing in one mom and pop store is probably, you know, there's just not enough of an upside to it. But if you can create this kind of index type thing, where, you know, you can get exposure to mom and pop globally or nationwide kind of thing, then that's something that becomes much more investable. You know, obviously, I'm hand waving a lot of details there, but that's something that could become much more investable than you know, trying to seek out specific instances of it.
Mm-hmm. And there's a very interesting point there too. I think, Oren, you were speaking to Walmart obviously having an advantage with like supply chain and distribution and all that. So, I mean, in terms of pricing, I'm sure they could be, they will continue to be competitive. But the thing that, you know, a token could potentially open up is that value line investment, right? Where it's like, hey, like I really am not just looking for the lowest price, but I am looking to support these local businesses because, you know, I believe in localism or, you know, whatever your value system might be. That otherwise would not be possible, right? I mean, it is possible to create these systems now, and I'd be really curious to see what the adoption would look like. But, you know, is there some feasible technical alternative that we can create to just, you know, Amazon, you know, ruling the world and, you know, everything becoming more centralized because of economies of scale? And I think this offers an interesting path because it's a technical one. And two, if the user experience is so simple that you do get it broad exposure, I think that's really, really powerful, right? We actually recently had Dr. Robin Hanson on our podcast, and he's, you know, the author of The Great Filter and, you know, economist professor. But he was really skeptical of, you know, this whole model because, you know, his argument was, hey, why don't you go start an index fund, you know, for a system like this? But we know the complexities that exist in the current system, and it would be nearly impossible to actually go set that up. There's just so much, you know, red tape, and, you know, how in the world would you even be able to coordinate all these mom and pop shops? So I think if the solution could be as simple as, you know, these shops joining their own DAO, you know, you can start seeing some of the impact of the technologies that we're all working on into the real world, right? It doesn't just have to be finance or, you know, speculation or, you know, pieces of art. We can start seeing it impact real people's lives. And I think that's when we'll see a big sort of turning point when, you know, people's everyday lives are really being improved because they're getting exposure that, you know, otherwise they wouldn't have had.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I'm still a little skeptical. I can very much see how it works in the context of larger scale kind of digital, you know, platform cooperative type scenarios where like your service is digital. I think it feels like a much more monumental challenge when you're talking about coordinating a bunch of brick and mortar stores. But I could see that manifesting in things like industry advocacy type groups, you know, things like how, say, like dairy farmers band together to put on commercials for milk. I could see similar things happening where you have, you know, like a group of mom and pop brick and mortar stores kind of banding together to create this kind of one unified lobbying, advertising type effort, and then that potentially kind of snowballing into something that becomes much more inclusive of customers and potentially investors and all that kind of thing. Like going straight from, you know, a bunch of disparate mom and pop stores to nationwide DAO feels like a monumentally difficult challenge.
I think the beauty of it though is it doesn't really have to be any large amount of coordination. You can really have something that's pretty lightweight. I think even just bundling these several mom and pop stores that are value aligned into one collective investment is pretty substantial and can substantially add value to all of these organizations. Maybe even, yeah, just some shared place to communicate as well.
Right. And Orna, I'm curious too, is it partially because of the, you know, we're bringing it into the physical world, that is that the part that makes you uncomfortable? Because you could easily imagine maybe a intermediary step might be, hey, a bunch of gamers, you know, we're looking to get more exposure to this market in, you know, Korea for Dota players. And otherwise we wouldn't have the, wouldn't have the opportunity to specifically target those individuals and pull them into this larger tribe.
Yeah, for sure. I think like the big piece of my hesitation there is just those things not being necessarily kind of digital natives, and their businesses being very dependent on things that are inextricably kind of tied to the physical world, you know, things like supply chains, which it's going to be harder to kind of excise them or like, you know, essentially create more efficiencies in that, you know, starting, say, like Rob, you mentioned like it can start with a small group. And it's like, you know, if you've got a group of two or three or four of these things, then that's like an approachable thing to start it with, but doesn't necessarily give any, or may not necessarily give any kind of meaningful additional kind of buying power or efficiencies in their, in how their supply chains works. And it would more than likely require kind of competing mom and pops in the same kind of region to now kind of band together. And I think there'd potentially be some resistance to that. That said, I think this is one of the kind of beauties of kind of DAO-like organizations, is they can become these kind of multi-organizational networks where, you know, you have, you know, say, you know, three or four of these stores that would typically be kind of competing for customers, coordinating around something that makes all of their businesses more efficient. And so like from that point of view, I think there could be some value added there, but I don't necessarily see, in the context of those kind of brick and mortar stores, I don't necessarily see DAOs being the real enabler of that. Like you could enable that with a traditional co-op structure or the, you know, a co-op style legal entity and a spreadsheet.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily the coordination and organization that is the real value add. I really do think it's just sort of the token itself. If it's properly designed and it aligns incentives with the people that are currently big supporters of these businesses but have no way to get access to that, I think that if it's self-contained, can be something that can be deployed on for a single business at a time, and it can be scaled up in this way, in the sort of index fund fashion, trustlessly, and spread across many different organizations. It can be sort of a loose DAO where many different parent organizations might have shares within this mom and pop thing, right? But getting exposure across all of these different sectors potentially.
And there's another part there too. I feel like the nature of competition also starts to change, right? It's no longer the, you know, local mom and pop shops competing against each other, but, you know, they're actually in it together. They're cooperating and they're competing against the larger sort of, you know, the Walmarts that they otherwise could not have competed against, right? So it's a different level of the competition that's happening. You're still maintaining that aspect of free markets, which is tremendously efficient. It'll still force mom and pop shops to compete, but there's a different coordination game happening, which I think would be really interesting.
I think it's another interesting thought experiment is to think about this on the individual scale. If you have tokens for individuals that maybe grant access to portions of their earnings or something, you can imagine sort of investing in your friends. And I think could either go super dystopian or it could be a lot of fun. But interesting.
Yeah, I could see that getting dystopian real quick. I've been pretty skeptical of like personal tokens as well for that exact reason. One, it has like this really potentially kind of dystopian outcome. And then the other is that they're so trust-based. You know, like I create a token and I distribute it or sell it or whatever. There's this really loose promise that somehow I'll return value back to these token holders, you know, if my career is successful, then I'll return value back to token holders. And it's like, I could see how it can be useful in the context of some kind of more limited scopes, you know, say like a YouTuber or a streamer, and a Twitch streamer, or some kind of influencer like that, where like they're cultivating a community and the token is the kind of thing, is one of the pieces that helps to kind of tie together incentives for that community. But more generally, it doesn't feel like it's quite as useful. I had experimented for a while with the idea of essentially something akin to the kind of the current designs for personal tokens, but rather than, you know, having essentially an ERC 20 token that's this vague promise for your future time or future earnings or something like that, essentially creating a system where you could sell like specific units of your time via some mechanism. And so like you create a more concrete promise for what's actually redeemable for these tokens. It's obviously still very trust-based. It still requires you to actually show up and do the work for this person. But that feels like something that's more kind of usable there, and still allows for the same type of speculative investment from your friends if they really want to kind of take a gamble on your future demand. But again, is much more concrete.
One interesting way to ground it, looking at the case of maybe like a software developer that's doing contract work, right? You could price your own services in your token. I think that's a good way to ground it, and that, you know, grounds the value of the future supply as well. If you're going to continue offering your services in this token, right, then there's continued demand for it. And it really, in this case, should be tied to in a way, it's sort of reflecting the market value for your labor, right? I think that mechanism is pretty interesting, especially introducing it to a broader market.
I do think you need both those components, right? The medium of exchange, but also, and as you were saying, like a fixed sort of redeemable quantities of work, right? Like that's listed in the marketplace, and you know, you can go and acquire that, because that will always be something that is like, there's some fixed value that you can derive from the value of the tokens that you hold.
Don't know about that though. I think a lot of the value of the token comes from the individual's control over it, right? Like being able to set their price at any time in their own token.
Right.
What stops you setting the price in something else? Like it to me, that feels like just adding an extra step to the transaction. Like you're choosing, you know, if you set the price higher or lower in your personal token, then you're really just setting it higher or lower in whatever the more liquid asset that you're going to.
Yeah. The thing is, I think setting it in the token provides that incentive for people to get into your token in the first place, which you do need. And as long as it reflects some actual market value, then I think.
Objection or like my hesitation with most of the personal tokens that I've seen so far is that they've been, you essentially create this personal token, and a lot of them have been like, essentially, I've got this personal token and you can redeem it for my time. You can redeem it to book in a call with me, or you know, to book, you know, X amount of hours of developer work or whatever it is. And to me, the kind of ambiguity about that, essentially like the availability of that time, is a huge unknown for someone who's buying the token. You know, I may say, okay, I need 10 hours of dev work done, or I need 2 weeks of dev work done, or whatever it is. And so I would like to buy the token, but without the additional information of when I can actually redeem it, of when I can get this work done, when I can turn this from the token that I've bought into the output that I need, it's really, really difficult then to kind of arrive at a valuation of that token. And that's where I say like having something kind of more concrete to me feels like it makes it much easier to actually assign a value to it. You know, there's a huge difference in value to me between your work next week versus your work next year, because the work next week is presumably much more useful for me. And so that's where I think like the current kind of formulation of personal tokens, at least in the context of redeeming 4 hours of work or something like that, is falls short of what is what would be really useful.
So I think the part where you need the pricing to be in the token itself is because you need to introduce other people that don't necessarily need your work, but just believe that your work has high value, right? The external participants in the market that aren't your customers, but are market participants, right?
Right. And so I don't have an issue with that. I'm more talking about the token design. I'm not saying that you can't tokenize that thing. I think the token design that seems pretty common where you use essentially a fungible ERC-20 token that you promise to be redeemable for your time. That's the part that I kind of take a little bit of an issue with, right? To me, just doesn't feel like quite the right fit. It seems like it would be a much better fit if you were tokenizing specific units of time that, again, people can buy and speculate on, but those specific units have a much more tangible kind of output and should thus have a much more tangible value. Or it should be much easier to kind of arrive at a valuation on them.
Yeah, I think the issue there is that sort of limits the use cases to really pretty simple ones. I think more complex ones do require more complicated parameters.
Yeah. And I think that's fair. That's obviously pushing this design more towards optimizing for a specific thing where you're trying to kind of buy units of time. And so obviously, if you want to have something more generalizable, then you need kind of a more flexible tool. And I think that goes back to the point we were talking about earlier, where it's really important to define the kind of outcomes that you're looking for before you implement some kind of system to solve for those outcomes. And that, again, that's where I think a lot of the kind of personal token designs think token first and outcome second, and end up with a mismatch fit as a result.
And that's the horror and the beauty of this space both, right? The amount of experimentation that's happening, the different models that we're seeing being played around with right now is just incredible. And I think we still have a long way to go, right? But it's conversations like these that, get us all thinking, get the neurons firing, and, we can start thinking what is actually possible with this technology. So, Oren, we do want to wrap up maybe with a few more questions, but through our research, we figured out that you are a father. So I'd like to ask you, what is the Web3 world that you want to see your children grow up in?
Yeah. So, I mean, one thing that I thought was really cool recently, and I didn't actually do it yet, I've been meaning to, but so Proof of Humanity and UBI is a system that was put together by Democracy Earth and Kleros, led in large part by Santi Siri. I think that's a really cool project. Essentially, UBI, Universal Basic Income, where anyone that's kind of verified as an individual on this Proof of Humanity registry basically just starts having these tokens accrue in their account. And so really, really early on in that system, I remember tweeting out asking those folks, hey, can I go and register my kids on this? Can I have them start accruing their own UBI? So 20 years from now, they've got 20 years of, or 18 years, whatever we want to give them access to it. They've got, all of these years of accrual that have happened. And I think those kind of things could be a really neat outcome for kids, probably less so for my kids and more so for kids elsewhere in the world that have less access to opportunity. This is a really beautiful system in terms of providing some baseline level of financial freedom to literally anyone that wants to participate, or at least anyone that can participate. There's still some barriers to entry in terms of having a device and the ability to securely store a private key, so it's not quite as ubiquitous or as the baseline level of access is not as low as I would like it to be. But yeah, I think those kind of systems have a really great chance of having a kind of hugely positive impact on humanity.
Wow. That's powerful stuff. Powerful stuff, man. It makes me want to go back. It's time to get back to building,
Absolutely.
Oren, really, really appreciate your time today. This was a wonderful conversation, and look forward to maybe seeing you again.
Thanks, Oren.
Yeah. Cheers, guys. Thanks, and Kit. Thanks, Rob. It's been a pleasure. A lot of fun.